Welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show here on 102.7 FM Co-op Radio, CFRO in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Today is Friday, June the 18th, 2010. I am your co-host, Allison Cole, and I am joined here today by my co-host, Joanne Chang.
Happy Friday, everyone.
And our technician, John Pranger, who is running the controls. We have two interviews coming up on the show today that I'm both really looking forward to. First, Glenn Gates, director of the local animal rights organization Liberation BC will be coming on the show to talk to us about creative online activism. So if you're like us and still don't get how to use Twitter, or if you want to find out more about using online tools such as Facebook websites and blogging to get your message across to the animals, then I think you'll find this interview very interesting. Glenn has a lot of expertise in this area and will be here to share some of that with us. And for our feature interview, we will be having Kitty Block, Vice President of the Humane Society International, on the show with us, where she is currently in Agadir, Morocco, to attend the annual meeting of the International Whaling Committee as an NGO representative. The issue that stands on the table of the IWC this month is the proposal to lift the 24-year moratorium on commercial whaling. This ban, which took effect in 1986, was considered to be one of the greatest environmental achievements of the 20th century. And now, next week on June the 21st, in fact, the members of the IWC will be meeting to decide whether or not to end this ban. As I mentioned on the show last week, there's a lot at stake here for the whales, and much of it seems to have to do with governmental politics. We will be finding out more about these issues on the interview later in the show. And once again, I'd like to bring to your attention the opportunity to keep the Animal Voices show running on the air. If you support the work that we do here every week at Animal Voices to bring you original quality programming on the topics of current animal issues and the vegan lifestyle, we ask of you to please show your support by becoming a member of Co-op Radio, because we do rely on your membership donations to keep this show running. To become a member, just simply go to www.cooperadio.org, where it will show you how to sign up. And remember to indicate Animal Voices on your donation form. We thank you in advance for your monetary support, and it doesn't matter how much or how little you contribute for your membership, because every little bit helps. And we are putting a call out to you, our listeners, to contact us if you are interested in being a guest co-host from time to time, or even just once if you want to just try it out on the Animal Voices radio show. If you're committed to helping the animals, like to hear the sound of your own voice, and want to have the opportunity to voice your thoughts and ideas about animal issues to the whole world, then please do contact us. But first, make sure that you are available on Fridays, or a Friday when our show airs live, to be in our studio in downtown Vancouver, Canada. No prior radio experience is necessary either. If this fits your schedule and interests, please email Joanne and I at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com, and we'll chat about it. We look forward to bringing in some new perspectives to the show from time to time. And also, if you're interested in helping out with the show but don't necessarily want to speak on the air, we are looking for people who might want to run the sound controls in our studio from time to time on the show as well, and full training will be provided. Once again, our email address is radioanimalvoices@gmail.com, and please put the words guest co-host in the subject title. We look forward to hearing from you. Joanne.
Great. Thank you for that, Allison. Last week, I told you in the news that BC has the highest instance of breeder-bought dogs in the country at 51%, when the national average is at 43%. I was quite shocked when I read this news, because I don't think British Columbians are especially irresponsible, but I do believe that a lot of well-meaning people will go out of their way to find quote-unquote reputable breeders to avoid buying from puppy mills. What people don't realize is that any breeder making a living by breeding can only be a very small step above a puppy mill. And this is why I believe this. Let's just say in our fantasy world, we find a responsible breeder who is doing it just for a hobby, not for profit. And she only has one breeding female who only produces one litter of 5 puppies per year. That would mean one extremely responsible breeder who is not even making a profit is capable of taking 5 perfectly good homes away from shelter dogs. So where does that leave all the breeders who are making a profit? How many homes are they taking away? Breeding, no matter how you cut it, is a dirty business. A breeder essentially exploits the reproduction system of a female dog and takes her babies away. The dog is nothing more than a puppy popping machine. Calling someone a responsible breeder makes as much sense as calling someone an ethical pimp. Would you be okay with a pimp who cares about his prostitutes and only pimps in small quantities, and the reason he does it is because he just loves selling beautiful women? I think most of us would find that quite sickening. So why do you think it's okay for someone to exploit the reproductive system of a dog for the love of a specific breed? Mm-hmm. A survey done by Ipsos Reid estimates that 35% of Canadian households have a dog. This means that around 4.3 million households have dogs. Yet each year, 36,000 dogs die needlessly in shelters. Nationally, 43% of dogs are breeder bought. This means that approximately 1.8 million homes would be available for shelter dogs if breeders were not out there impregnating and selling dogs. If you still feel that buying a dog is not wrong in any way and that you are not responsible for the pet overpopulation problem, I suggest that you go to the shelter and ask them to allow you to watch the euthanasia of a healthy and well-behaved shelter dog. Because unless you have that experience, you will never understand the harm of buying a dog. If a shelter won't let you sit through a euthanasia, you can watch the movie Earthlings online. I've also posted this video on our website at animalvoices.org in the front page, so you don't have to go searching for it. In the video, you will have the opportunity to watch the euthanasia of perfectly sweet, healthy, and even purebred animals at shelters. Reflect on the death of these beautiful animals and identify the role you play in the whole scheme of the pet overpopulation issue. Before seeking out a breeder puppy, consider volunteering at a shelter for just a while. You will find that shelters are inundated with well-trained, housebroken, lovable, young, and purebred dogs. In fact, most people cannot leave a shelter without falling in love with at least one dog. If you're obsessed with a specific breed, there are rescue organizations for just about every breed under the sun. The best part about shelter dogs is that most of them have already been housebroken and come with the knowledge of basic commands, as opposed to a unsocialized and unhousebroken newborn puppy from a breeder who will just pee all over your house until you train him, and which could take months. So please be a part of the solution, kick the breeder to the curb, and bring home a shelter dog. And remember, there is no such thing as a responsible breeder.
Thanks, Joanne. That was really, really excellent. I also want to say that it's really worthwhile even just to visit a shelter, like an animal shelter. I had never done so before until we went together last year in Portland, remember? Mm-hmm. And we really took the time to visit every single dog there. And wow, like those dogs are just amazing animals that really just need good homes. So
they were so sweet. Like they're all
pets, right?
Yeah. And you can tell they've been around, you know, the home.
Yeah, we'd say shake a paw and they'd lift up her paw. Like they know how to live with families.
Exactly.
And it's just heartbreaking to think that, you know, some of them might not find homes because people aren't going to shelters because they're going to breeders. And,
right.
And at that specific shelter, there were purebreds there.
Oh, tons.
Remember?
I think every single one of them was a purebred. It's so hard to find mutts, really. I mean, there are so many, you know, like, where do they come from? They all come from breeders.
Yeah.
Essentially.
So that is a great point to say, you know, if you want a full bred dog, they're in shelters and the rescue organizations that rescue specific types of breeds.
Right. And just because an animal is a little bit older doesn't mean you won't fall in love with them, because you will. Like, it was so hard for us to leave that shelter. We wanted to take home so many.
I fell in
them.
Love with these two little dogs, Smokey and Honey. I wanted them so bad. And I still think about them to this day. Anyways, on to our upcoming events. On Sunday, June the 20th at 7 o'clock p.m., there's a vegan secret supper at a secret location in Vancouver. This dinner is at 7 o'clock p.m. this week. Secret suppers are home-prepared meals served in people's homes for a set fee in a secret location. This week's menu features a four-course menu, Brazil nut and walnut tuna, in quotes, with apple and spring onion, toasted on house sourdough, leek and sunchoke puree with watercress, lemon rosemary roasted rainbow beets with herbed cashew cheese and creamy zucchini pate, and for dessert, a hazelnut mousse with salmon berry compote and lavender crisps. All that for $30. If you would like to make a reservation, email vegansecretsupper@gmail.com. Tuesday, June the 22nd at 7 o'clock p.m., there will be a vegan dine-out at Nuba Restaurant hosted by Earth Save Canada. This is at 146 East 3rd Avenue in Vancouver. This is their newest location. Backed by popular demand, Earth Save is having another dine-out at Nuba, one of the favorite Lebanese restaurants in the city. I went to this last dine-out there, and it was delicious, so I am totally recommending this one, and I will be there myself. Inclusive price, which includes tax and tip, is $20 if you're an EarthSave member and $23 for non-members. Everyone is welcome to attend. We will enjoy this delicious, mostly organic Lebanese buffet at Nuba's new location off Main Street, which just opened in March. On the menu this time, a red lentil soup, fattoush and or tabbouleh salads, manouche, which are Lebanese flatbreads with za'atar, spicy tomatoes, spinach, and pine nuts, a mezze sampler, which includes baba ganoush, hummus, homemade pickle, falafel, eggplant stew, fresh cucumber, Najib's special cauliflower, and laffa bread, and the new Lebanese baked pastries brought to you by Vegan Mania. To register, please go to meetup.com and search for Vancouver Meatless Meetup. Next week, from Friday, June the 25th to Sunday, June the 27th, is the 2010 Let Live Animal Rights Conference. This is an annual conference that takes place in Portland, Oregon. The 2010 Let Live Animal Rights Conference will be held at Portland State University. This year's conference will focus on creative activism and expanding your activist skills to build relationships in the movement and beyond. The goal is to help everyone realize their potential so they can utilize their unique abilities to further the movement as a whole. There is an exciting lineup of speakers set for the conference, people who have taken what they love and used it to help animals. Some of these speakers include people that we have featured on the show already, such as Jasmine Singer from our hen house, Gary Lowenthal of the Worldwide Vegan Bake Sale, and Josh Hooten of Herbivore Clothing Company. At this three-day conference, you can talk to speakers, get inspired, and make new friends. For more information and for a full list of the speakers and the weekend's activities, please visit the website www.letlivefoundation.org/conference. And finally, on Friday, June the 25th at 6:30 p.m., if you're not going to Portland, you should, and you're going to be in town here in Vancouver, I recommend going to the EarthSave Monthly Readers Group meeting hosted by EarthSave Canada. This is going to be taking place at Organic Lives, the new raw vegan restaurant at 1829 Quebec Street at 2nd Avenue in Vancouver in the Culinary School Room. The EarthSave Readers Group is a great opportunity to meet informally to discuss various topics related to the health, environmental, and ethical consequences of our food choices, and we read many books on animal rights issues. This month's book is Gary Francione's Animals as Persons, Essays on the Abolition of Animal Exploitation, which I actually have started reading myself. You don't need to have read the book, though, to join in on the food and the discussion, and those who have read the book will each be presenting one chapter about it. All are welcome to attend. I will mention quickly one more quick event. The next day after that, Saturday, June the 26th at 6 p.m. will be the first Vegan Beach Potluck of the summer hosted by EarthSave Canada at Jericho Beach in Vancouver. EarthSave Summer Beach Potlucks are back, and this event marks the first one of the summer. Make sure to bring a dish for sharing with no animal products in it so that everyone from vegan to omnivore can partake. Don't forget to bring a serving spoon, a plate, cutlery, and something to drink. If the weather looks like rain, the potluck will be held the next day on Sunday at 5:30 p.m. For more information and exact details of where to meet, visit www.earthsave.ca. If you have an animal or a vegetarian-related event coming up that you would like to have announced in the show, please email us the details at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com or post it on our Facebook page, which is called Animal Voices Vancouver. Today we are speaking with Glenn Gates, who is a director of the organization Liberation BC. Liberation BC is a Vancouver-based animal rights organization dedicated to liberating animals through education, outreach, and advocacy. Today Glenn brings his expertise to speak with us about creative online activism. Hello Glenn, and welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show.
Hey Glenn.
Hi Allison. Hey, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Thanks for coming. So before we start, we're going to be one of the many speakers featured on the upcoming Let Live Animal Rights Conference in Portland, Oregon next weekend. Can you tell us a bit about the conference and the topics that you'll be speaking on?
Yeah, the conference is an amazing grassroots event. It's one of the few animal rights conferences that's focused on the grassroots. So it ranges from individual activists to small local organizations that are really, I think, doing a majority of the work in animal rights these days. My talks are going to be around creative outreach, talking a little bit about our Cow Ribbon campaign that we just finished. I'm going to be talking about online activism with Jasmine Singer, because she does an amazing job with that too. And I'm also doing a session on the animal advocacy camp that we held in January.
Right.
Which should be fun and educational. It's like a how to run one of those.
Well, in regards to using online tools and online activism, I know you've been doing that for quite some time with Liberation BC. I want to ask you, what is your main purpose for using these tools, and can you give us a brief summary of what online methods you are using these days?
Well, we try to use our use of online tools is to reach, one, supporters, people who we might want to take action on our behalf or take action on something we're interested in, and two, to reach new people. So Liberation BC started off essentially as an email list. So email has been central to any organizing efforts that we've done. Any protests and things have been organized by email, essentially. We added in a website pretty quickly as soon as we could get that together, and that now is a great resource of content. And then we added in a blog a few years ago, which has been a great tool. And since then, we've also utilized Facebook quite well, I think. It's great to get people from all across the world engaged on Facebook. And more recently, I've started using Twitter to some benefit.
So what do you like about each of these different tools? Would you say that each one serves a different purpose, conveying a message in a different way or to different people?
Yeah, I think each one does serve a different purpose, and a lot of it is around the audience that you're intending to reach. Email, you're reaching people who have signed up to be on your list. A website is a great place to put information that we'll be able to find as a resource. Things like Facebook and Twitter are great tools for connecting with people, but they do tend to be much more short-term. So there are all sorts of different audiences, and choosing the right tool for the right audience is important.
Right. So there's definitely a need for different types of communication, I guess, just to get the message out there in a way that's effective for whatever type, you know, all the different kinds of people that are out there that use different kinds of methods, right?
Right. Right, yeah.
And, of course, there's real-life communication as well, and Liberation BC is very active in the community in person as well. How do you think your use of online methods has perhaps strengthened your communication effectiveness in the real world when you're meeting real people?
Well, at almost every event now, we have people come up and say, oh, I follow you on Twitter, or I know you on Facebook. And that just adds to the depth of the relationship that we can build in person.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a real believer in face-to-face communication and having face-to-face events. But utilizing the online social networking and information spreading to get people to those face-to-face events, to introduce people to the ideas so that when they come to a face-to-face event, they've already, in some ways, started the conversation. It gets the conversation started, and then face-to-face you can really have a dialogue and deepen the conversation.
That's great. So let's talk about Twitter, since this is the one social networking method that Joanne and I are still getting used to, mm-hmm. and is quite new to us. We have a Twitter account, a page, I guess you could call it.
Yeah, so, and I'd like to apologize to anybody who's written to us.
Yeah, that's what you're saying.
Yeah, we never noticed that you wrote to us.
We don't
know how to use it.
Yeah, I was trying to figure that out the other day. So what is Twitter all about, and can you give us some tips on how to tweet?
Twitter, it's really simple. It's basically your Facebook status message, a little bit shorter, and that's it.
140 characters, right?
And, yeah, 140 characters.
Which makes it really hard sometimes to write a message of what's coming up on the show.
When you have a lot to say.
Yeah. So a lot of what people write on Twitter is links. So they'll say, check out our next show. It's going to be great. And a short link to the show on the website. That's how a lot of people share those things. I think one of the most important things about Twitter is sort of building relationships mm-hmm. with other people, because you can interact on Twitter with people that you would never encounter otherwise. You know, like, there is no way that I would be able to interact with an author of a book or someone who is an actor or a journalist, really.
You know, Ashton Kutcher has 5 million followers or friends or whatever you want to call them. So there's 5 million people connected to him and knowing what he's doing every day.
Liberation BC is closely behind Ashton Kutcher.
At how many followers?
We're catching up. We have 2,000.
Whoa, 2,050 getting there.
Or something.
Yeah. That's actually quite amazing, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's pretty
great.
Good.
Yeah.
I mean, we're at about, I think the last time I checked, the Humane Society of the U.S. had 30,000 or something.
That's great for them.
But they're brilliant at it. Mm-hmm.
And then Facebook is the other big one. What suggestions do you have for using Facebook to promote your message to the masses?
Facebook, it's much more like you're talking to your friends. Mm-hmm. So I think treating communication on Facebook like you would treat communication to anyone in person is good. You know, you share things on Facebook. You don't want to overshare things. You want to be normal.
You want to be normal as opposed to being abnormal on
Twitter? As opposed to putting everything in all caps and only posting videos of animals getting skinned, very quickly people are going to ignore you.
Yeah.
You wouldn't talk to someone like that. You don't want to do it on Twitter, on Facebook, because Facebook, it's really like normal people communicating with each other. Mm-hmm. Facebook was built as, you know, this real person talking to this real person, and it should be treated that way.
So Twitter, on the other hand, is not necessarily a reciprocal relationship. Is that right?
Right. People might follow you. You might follow other people, but they don't necessarily, they don't have to follow you back. Mm-hmm. And the relationship is different, too. There are lots of newspapers that just simply post content. What's nice about Twitter is that people don't necessarily expect you to post conversationally. You know, they might follow you because you're mm-hmm. posting information about animal rights issues. But then the expectation with Twitter, though, is that if they respond to you, you should really be listening and responding back.
So there is a bit of a committed relationship there with Twitter.
Yeah. There's engagement. You want to have that open conversation.
Okay. You also have your Liberation BC blog. Can you give us some examples of what kind of information you post in your blog and what some of the past topics have been about?
Yeah. We've had the blog for a couple of years, and I went down through the top posts. The most popular post on the blog of all time is the review of Food Incorporated that I did.
Oh, okay.
Then there was a post I did about PETA's seal hunt campaign when they unveiled their new logo, the Inukshuk clubbing. And then I wrote this post once as part of a blogathon about why vegetarian and vegan girls are so hot. And that is number 3 of all time.
Wow. And I guess that's because it's got the words hot girls in it. And people are Googling that a lot.
If you look at the top ones, then actually number 4 is a post that Joanne wrote about her trip down to Washington to help with a puppy mill rescue.
Oh, that's awesome. That's amazing. So the hot girls is sandwiched right in between the seals and the puppies.
Yeah,
so.
You've got Food Inc., PETA, vegetarian hotness, and puppies.
Yeah.
I think that sort of, they're very Googleable.
And you know what I also learned from Jasmine Singer of our Hen House recently is that if you put a celebrity's name in the title of your blog post, it's going to get a lot of hits.
It's true.
So there's a good tip for some.
We should start talking about hot girls, puppies, and Pamela Anderson or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
even as a social experiment. Can you give us some tips for blogging, Glenn?
Yeah, one of the really important things is finding your own voice. So spend a little time trying to be authentic. Don't try to write like someone else. Don't try to write like a journalist. Write, you know, in the first person from your perspective. And I think the most important thing about starting to blog is start posting before you're ready.
Yeah.
Don't wait until, you know, you're fully confident in your abilities to write. You know exactly what you're going to write about. Set up the blog. Start posting. Because really no one's going to read it until 6 months from now anyway. So it's good to you sort of build up your bank of posts and get you find your voice. You figure out what you write about, how you're going to write about it, and just sort of doing it is the best way.
How do you get people to read your blog? Like, how do people know it's there?
Well, that's where the whole social networking and all of these things start to connect, is that you've got your blog, and then every time you write a post, you post it on Facebook. Mm-hmm. Post it on your personal Facebook. And we also have a Facebook group, so I post Liberation BC blog posts on there, a link to it on there. I also post that about it on Twitter.
And that's how you're getting your readers to your blog.
Yeah, and then people come to it. I also, you know, it's a good idea to periodically write a post that references other bloggers, you know, sort of build a relationship between your blog and other animal rights blogs or similar topic blogs, because then they're likely to reciprocate back and mention you. And I've had Stephanie Ernst from Animal Rights and Anti-Oppression has mentioned some of our posts periodically, and that really helps get people to the blog, reading it, and sharing it.
So please tell us about your Cow Ribbon campaign, which I think is a great example of how the internet can be a very effective tool to run a whole campaign. What was the Cow Ribbon campaign all about?
Well, we did the Cow Ribbon campaign to raise awareness about the mothers and the calves of the dairy industry. So we created these actual cow print ribbons, much like the breast cancer ribbons, except Holstein patterned, and we sold them on the internet for a donation of $5 or more. And people from all over the world ordered these cow ribbons from Singapore. We had orders from Australia, Puerto Rico, all over the U.S. and Canada, the U.K., everywhere. So we sent out over 300 cow ribbons to people who ordered them. It was a pretty decent fundraiser for us.
That was within a three-week period, right?
Yeah.
Not bad, 100 a week.
Yeah, it was pretty good. We also had a website where people could order the ribbon that had e-cards, images that they could use for their Facebook or Twitter pictures.
I think people really liked this campaign because it was so unique and really easy, you know, and those ribbons are really great conversation starters.
Yeah, it is. It starts the dialogue. That's what kind of the plan was, is to give people an easy way to start a conversation about dairy. Because it's one of the big problems is that you can't just jump in and start talking about dairy.
Yeah, I've had a couple questions about mine, like, oh, what's that for? And it was coming to be Mother's Day, right? And like, oh, it's for Mother's Day. And they even right away, they kind of make the connection. Oh, dairy cows are mothers, you know? But what I wasn't thinking of is that this was actually a good fundraising tool for you as well. And I think you made quite a bit of money on it, huh?
Yeah, it did. It did pretty well as a fundraiser. There's a great value in having this cow ribbon that people can wear, and people were happy to support it.
Mm-hmm. How many e-cards were sent out you had Mother's Day e-cards on your website?
Yeah, I forgot to write down the count of them.
I think you told me it was over 300.
Yeah, I think it was something like 300 actual e-cards sent out to different people.
They're really nice cards.
Yeah, it was another fun way to spread the word. Anyone could come and use the e-card. I also set up ways so it was easy for people to share it on Twitter and share it on Facebook.
Yeah, it was a great campaign.
Yeah, all sorts of trying to take advantage of all these different ways of social networking.
Right. Well, thank you for coming on the show today, Glenn, to share with us your wisdom about all these fantastic online tools that animal activists and any activists, for that matter, can use to convey their message to the public. To find Liberation BC online and on Facebook and Twitter and all that, you can go to www.liberationbc.org to get all the info there. Thanks, Glenn.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
You are listening to Animal Voices on Co-op Radio 102.7 FM, and it is time for Animal Voices News. Numbers of Pacific bluefin tuna may be about to go the same way as those of their Atlantic cousins. The Pacific population was thought to be the endangered fish's only remaining stronghold, but officials' reports on stock sizes have overlooked changes to fishing practices that could mean they are heading for a crash, according to recent assessments. In the Atlantic Ocean and the Mediterranean Sea, fishing has caused tuna populations to fall below 15% of their historical levels. By contrast, Pacific bluefin populations had been thought to be stable, with enough young fish maturing each year to replace those caught. However, the belief that the stock is stable is based on a false assumption that fishing practices have not changed, says Toshio Katsukawa, a fisheries expert at Mie University in Japan. From speaking to fishermen, Katsukawa is most concerned that in the past few years, boats have begun targeting the tuna spawning grounds. This tactic increases catches, simultaneously making the stock seem bigger but damaging the fish's breeding capacity. If things go on like this, the Pacific bluefin populations will be the first to collapse before the Atlantic stock, says Katsukawa. Overall, more than 70% of the Pacific bluefin catch is taken by fishermen from Japan, where the fish is prized for its use in sushi. The Canadian Food Inspection Agency is expanding an existing recall of ready-to-eat meat products from Smith's Quality Meats. The agency says the affected products, which may be contaminated with listeria, were distributed in British Columbia, Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, Ontario, Northwest Territories, and Nunavut. The precautionary measure, Winnipeg-based Smith's is voluntarily recalling all of the products. The expanded recall follows an earlier voluntary recall of Lister's brand's Montreal smoked meat pouches, distributed in Ontario, Quebec, and Atlantic Canada. Also, as a result of the possibility of listeria contamination, this is the third meat recall in Canada in as many days.
That's just crazy. I know. Don't eat that stuff, people. It's not good for you.
And, you know, listeria was so bad. Remember the maple leaf one that killed quite
a few
people?
Was that listeria too?
Mm-hmm. And then they cleaned up and said it was all fine and good. And then there was another outbreak. So
It's the fact that these packed meats are just scraps from the slaughterhouse floor. If that's not bad enough for you to stay away from them because of, you know, things like listeria.
Right. And it's like you say, oh, you know, just cook your meat and you're fine. But these packaged meats are cooked. They're totally cooked.
That's why they're being recalled.
Right. This week, some exciting news. Celebrity trainer Bob Harper from the reality TV show The Biggest Loser told Veg News that he has gone vegan, cutting all animal products out of his diet, and shared that the switch to a cruelty-free diet has improved his health. I enjoy living a plant-based diet because it makes me feel clear-headed and strong, not to mention my genetically high cholesterol dropped more than 100 points. That was all the motivation I needed, says Harper. Harper has been a longtime vegetarian, often promoting meat-free recipes.
I hope this will mean that there's more of a vegan influence on The Biggest Loser.
Yeah, I hope so. And, you know, it's surprising. Like, this guy is as fit as you can get, and his cholesterol dropped 100 points from going vegan. So that just shows you, like, you know, when people eat meat and say, oh, I exercise a lot, it doesn't help. Your cholesterol comes from animal products.
And that's all it comes from.
That's what clogs your heart. So you can exercise all you want. You're still not going to get rid of the cholesterol.
Thanks for the news, Joanne.
Yeah.
For our feature interview, we have Kitty Block on the show today, who is the vice president of the Humane Society International, one of the few international animal protection organizations in the world working to protect all animals, and that includes the whales. Next week at the annual meeting of the International Whaling Commission in Agadir, Morocco, a proposal is on the table that could see the end of the 24-year ban on commercial whaling. Kitty joins us live from Morocco today, where she is attending the meeting of the IWC to speak to us about the issue. Hello, Kitty, and welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show.
Welcome, Kitty.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
Thank you for speaking to us all the way from Morocco. Mm-hmm. Before we get into the issue of the proposal to lift the 24-year moratorium on commercial whaling, could you tell us a bit about, first, what the International Whaling Commission is? Why does it exist, and when was it founded, and who is it made up of?
Sure. The International Whaling Commission was established in 1946. It was one of the first international agreements to cover an animal, you know, solely an animal, not an environmental agreement, but an animal agreement. And at the time, these were all whaling nations. Even the U.S. had this vibrant whaling industry. And the countries came together because they were all whaling nations. They were all slaughtering hundreds of thousands of whales. And they got to the point where they realized that they didn't have enough product left because they were basically killing everything in the oceans. Mm-hmm. And so when it first came together, it really was a whaler's club. It was an exclusive whaler's club. And fortunately, it evolved over time. Of course, the U.S. got out of commercial whaling, so did many, many other countries. And then in 1982, after the horrible 60s and 70s, when so many whales were killed, 8 out of 10 species of great whales were slaughtered to commercial extinction. Hmm. And so it got to the point where the countries realized they had no choice. Not that they wanted to give up whaling, not that they were trying to do the right thing, they just realized there was no industry left. So in 1982, they passed a ban on commercial whaling. And that ban has held until now.
So now that there is this proposal that currently stands on the table of the IWC, and it's to be decided in Morocco on June 21st in just 3 days about what the fate of the whales will be, according to what you know, what is the purpose of this proposal? From what I learned recently, it originated in 2007 under the Bush government, but that was then overturned. How is it that it's back up for consideration now at this time? And what will it mean for the whaling nations of Japan, Norway, and Iceland if this proposal is accepted?
Well, you're correct. I mean, this started, this whole idea of giving something to the whaling nations in exchange for something else started in 2007 under Bush. Now, even though there was a moratorium that was passed in 82 and enforced in 86, three countries continued to exploit the ban, and they circumvented the wishes of the majority of civil society and the countries involved. Japan, by exploiting loopholes, which said you can go scientific whaling, and so in the name mm-hmm. of so-called science, Japan killed thousands of whales. Iceland and Norway have taken objections, reservations to the ban, and so they have continued whaling. Iceland had a hiatus, but Norway's continued throughout. And so when the administration changed, we all had high expectations that this effort undertaken by the Bush administration to give something to the whaling nations in exchange for ways to allow, in the U.S., we have Alaskan natives who do kill whales for subsistence reasons. Mm-hmm. And so Japan would block that vote. That requires a vote at the IWC for them to get the quota. So in an effort to secure that vote, the U.S. felt they had to give something to Japan, and that's what started this, the origins of this deal.
So it's a bargaining chip.
It's a bargaining chip, and it's very sad. It's unfortunate. It exploits the Inuit in the region, and it hurts the whales.
So what does this mean for the population of the whales and the whales themselves? Can you talk to us about some of the present day dangers that they already face and how allowing whaling, if this proposal passes, will affect these dangers?
Right. And this would be, as you stated, this would be the first time, you know, in well over 20 years that commercial whaling will be legitimate. Industries that are now declining will get a lifeline. And this will reinvigorate industries. These animals right now are under such extreme and significant pressures. I mean, we only need to look to the most recent oil spill in the Gulf. These animals are under pressure from oil spills, ship strikes, and so many other anthropomorphic threats. It is not the time, nor is it ever the time. But specifically now, if we're just talking about the threats to their survival, to then add this layer of commercial whaling. I mean, commercial whaling in the 21st century is an abomination. It should have gone away and died a natural death a long time ago. And the fact that it would be brought back now is actually not only irresponsible and reckless, but it's frightening in many ways that this would be brought back, considering everything that we're doing to these animals in the ocean.
Under the proposal, fewer whales would be killed for the first 10 years than are killed now, apparently. But do you feel that this proposal legitimizes whaling for the future and would surely lead to more whales being killed in the long run?
That's the key question. And many of us disagree that, in fact, fewer whales will be killed. Because it's a numbers game right now. They're putting out numbers. It's a political game. These numbers that they're putting in this chart are not based on science. It actually goes against the science based on the scientific committees within the IWC's own advice. And it's a game. It's paper whales. Japan says, for instance, we will take 900 whales next year. But they, in fact, didn't take 900. They took closer to 600. So if what's in the table is closer to 600, it looks like there's a decrease from 900. Mm-hmm. But those were paper whales. They were never taken. And, in fact, Iceland, under this deal, they get triple what they were killing before.
Yeah.
So it's none of these whaling countries have agreed to these numbers. And it's not just the numbers that are problematic. I mean, of course, I am supportive 100% of less whales dying every year. I want no whales dying, but I'd be supportive of less. But the framework of this deal, it's not binding. These are promises. These are promises from whaling nations that have done nothing but undermine the convention for 20-plus years. Why should we trust them now?
Right. It's common knowledge, and as you were saying, that Japan, Norway, and Iceland have been illegally whaling now for years since the moratorium was put into place. Japan does it under the guise of scientific research, but is clearly using the whales to sell meat. How are they able to get away with that?
Yeah, it doesn't pass the laugh test. I mean, it really doesn't. I mean, Japan says this is for science, and then all the meat ends up in restaurants and supermarkets. I don't even know how to describe it. It's shameless. The convention, the way it was drafted, again, this was a 1946 convention, you know, post-World War II. It did not anticipate the countries exploiting it. And so the provision was drafted for true science. If there was a sudden die-off, if there was a sudden disease, and the way the language is drafted in the convention, it lets a country do anything, really, in the name of science. But they never anticipated it being other than for real science. So a country technically can supposedly kill a whale under this loophole and then do anything they want with its meat.
Right, right. Can you tell us how this vote will work next week within the International Whaling Commission? Who will be voting and what votes are needed to stop this proposal from passing? And based on that, what are the general perceptions or what is your opinion on the chances that this proposal has to be stopped or to be passed?
Well, it's a good question. This is an 88-member body, and the U.S. is supportive of this package. Mm-hmm. The Caribbean, which tends to vote with Japan, for no secret, as I don't know if you saw the U.K. Times article where they talk about vote buying, Japan buying votes in favor of it. And so there are a lot of countries that just support Japan because of the foreign aid. You've got EU countries. We have 21 EU countries in the IWC. They have to vote as a bloc.
Right.
And Denmark is a whaling nation because of Greenland, because they have their territory Greenland, and so they support whaling. Sweden supports a resumption of commercial whaling. And so what it does is it lowers the strong will of the UK and of other countries within the EU. So right now, they don't have a position yet, and we are continuing to put pressure on those countries to get them to have a common position to oppose this deal. And so the strongest group to emerge right now is the Latin bloc, the Buenos Aires group, as they call themselves. This is Brazil, Argentina, and others. They are the sole voice in trying to stop this vote from going through. If I add the numbers up right now, I can't say. It's too close to count. Especially it depends on what happens with the European countries. But it's anyone's guess what happens next week.
Right. I just want to remind our listeners that this is the Animal Voices radio show on 102.7 FM CFRO in Vancouver, Canada. As you were saying, and it's also been noted in the press, that even President Obama is now in favor to adopt this proposal, even though in his election campaign he had pledged to stop the slaughter of whales. I've read that the White House says the new agreement will save whales by keeping the three countries from exploiting loopholes in the current moratorium. But what do you think of this as being a reason to support the proposal?
That's a really good question. It doesn't stop these countries from exploiting the loopholes. This proposal does not amend the convention. It does not go to the heart of the problem. It does a temporary hold that's non-binding on countries that have never honored their agreements. And so we challenge the administration to come up with why this, in fact, will hold these countries. And they don't really have any answers. Their mantra is, we want less whales killed. Well, yeah, we all do. But this is not the way to get there. The way to get there is to close these loopholes first. You can't give commercial whaling to countries that have acted in bad faith for 20-plus years and expect them suddenly to do something good. What you have to do is clean up the problems of this old agreement and then talk to them. It's but like, not the other way around.
Yeah, they're rewarding these people that have been conducting illegal activities. Seems like what it comes down to.
Exactly. And South Korea made this intervention yesterday and said, look, we had this vibrant whaling industry, and we stopped. You know, 1986, right. We stopped. Right. These three countries didn't. And now you guys, you know, this body wants to reward them with commercial whaling. Hey, we want a commercial whale. And we're willing to go by science. These three countries aren't. And so how do you answer that question? I mean, has the administration thought about that?
Right. You mentioned this earlier. An investigation conducted by London Sunday Times revealed that officials from six of the 88 countries that make up the IWC were willing to consider selling their votes for call girls in cash payments and have admitted on film that they have already accepted cash payments in envelopes at IWC meetings from Japanese officials and were offered prostitutes by Japanese fisheries ministers and other civil servants. What do these kinds of actions say to you about the hands that the fate of the whales are in?
Well, it's really a very scary thought. I mean, the idea that countries' positions can be bought in this way, and it's a very sad reflection because I've been to the Caribbean. We had several IWC meetings in the Caribbean, for instance, and I talked to their citizens, and I, you know, we went on the radio programs. Their citizens are not in favor of commercial whaling. So you have this high-level tier that gets co-opted, and their citizens are not in favor, and they don't have a voice. It takes away the voice of the citizens. And when you have a convention like the IWC, with every country has one vote, and it turns on a three-quarters majority, every vote counts. And every vote should really represent their citizenry, not the interests of one whaling nation.
If this proposal goes through next week, based on the structure of the IWC, what do you think the chances are for it to be reversed in the future?
It won't. We won't be able to muster the three-quarters majority again. If this deal goes through, we are now looking at commercial whaling. And that is the concern, and that is the real problem. And when this has been raised, people say, the U.S. and other countries say, well, at least it's better than what the status quo is. Well, no, it's not. Commercial whaling, legitimized, legalized commercial whaling is not better than the status quo. So my hope is they'll have a better answer come next week.
What kind of measures has HSI and the Humane Society of the United States taken to raise awareness of this issue and to garner support from the public?
We have gone out to our membership. We have 11 million members and supporters.
Wow.
We have reached out to them. We have activist lines. We have done rallies on Earth Day. We have joined with Pierce Brosnan and other groups, and we have done PSAs, and we broadcast them all over the United States and in Europe. We are writing articles, releases, everything we can do to reach the greatest number of people and encourage them to contact their governments, especially those governments that are part of the IWC, and vote no to this deal.
What can people do now about it?
What I would recommend is if you go on our website, www.hsi.org, we can direct you to, depending on your country, if it's in the U.S., we can give you action alerts to members of Congress, who, by the way, have been fantastic. We have letters from the House and letters from the Senate going into Obama, calling on him not to support this deal and to step up and be a leader for whale protection. And if you are from outside the U.S., we have links and everything to your prime ministers and your ministers of environment.
What is your role as a representative of the Humane Society International with this meeting of the IWC this week? I'm curious as to what you are doing there and what your role is.
Sometimes I wonder what I'm doing here with everything that's happening. But no, seriously, this forum has many NGOs that are here. Mm-hmm. We are granted observer positions. Okay. And we can speak. We draft papers. I'm a lawyer, and I give legal arguments to the countries. We have scientists who also provide arguments, and we lobby every step of the way. We are here from beginning to end.
What kind of feedback have you been getting for those from those that you have been lobbying to?
It depends on the country. I mean, the Latin group, the Buenos Aires group, they are thankful. They are helpful. They want support. They want to be recognized for the good work they're doing, and we are doing everything to encourage that and highlight. The Buenos Aires group, they are trying to put the emphasis on non-lethal, not killing these animals, whale watching. They have a vibrant whale watching industry. They want support for their whale watching industry, and we are doing everything we can to help them. Industry of whaling and killing them, it's anachronistic. It should no longer be a part of this 21st century. Mm-hmm. Whale watching is the new industry, and that's what we're trying to promote.
I'm curious about what are the arguments being presented by the pro-whaling nations in favor of passing this proposal. I've read that Japan claims that the whale populations have recovered, and thus it should be okay to legally resume whaling. What do you have to say to that?
Well, that's nice for them, and it's convenient for them to say, because a lot of the abundance studies are done by the whaling nations. They're the ones who are counting the whales while they're out killing them. So all very convenient and highly circumspect. Many of the world's noted scientists, and in fact, Sylvia Earle and many of the marine biologists around the country have signed on to a statement saying, before Japan can slice up the pie and take their pieces, we don't even know what the pie is. We don't even know the whales that are out there. Mm-hmm. There are studies that are saying that we are not even close to recovering the pre-heyday of commercial whaling. Back then, there was killing without regard and without understanding. We don't know where they are. They are incredibly hard to count. It's nearly impossible to know the current status of these animals.
And I've also read, too, that there's even some whales on the endangered species list, the fin and the sei whales, that will now be allowed to be hunted. Is that correct?
That is correct.
How can that be possible?
Because this is a political game, and it's political numbers and political species. Why the conservation countries are trying to accommodate the whaling countries by giving them fin and sei is beyond me. These species, especially fin, their meat is valued much more highly on the market. Minke whales, the other whales, the smaller whales, the ones that are not on the endangered list, they're considered commonplace, and their meat mm-hmm. is not as valued. So they want the higher price tag. And there's this one thing I wanted to point out about this great deal that, you know, countries are trying to put forward now, is that this deal we will have to pay for it. U.S. citizens will have to pay. Their tax dollars will go to funding whaling, because the way this deal is structured right now is that when whaling is resumed, there will be this monitoring, inspection, and all this other sort of systems in place. It is going to cost U.S. taxpayers to fund this, as it's going to cost Australia and other anti-whaling countries, mm-hmm. because Japan and the other whaling nations are not going to bear the cost of this alone. That's part of this current proposal.
Right. Well, thank you so much, Kitty, for coming on the Animal Voices show today to speak to us about this important international issue concerning the whales.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you covering this.
I really appreciate you coming on the show. For more information on the IWC proposal and the whales, please visit the Humane Society International's website at www.hsi.org.
Thank you, Allison, for that informative interview. Coming up next week, we will be interviewing Helen Savkovic from the Richmond Animal Protection Society about their success in banning the sale of rabbits at pet stores in Richmond. We will also be speaking with Laura Lee Shaw, who is desperately trying to save the rabbits at University of Victoria from a massive call that is currently underway at the university. And after listening to the interview with Glenn Gates, I really like to encourage you to join us online. Yes. Follow us on Twitter, Animal Voices YVR. We might not notice you for a while until we figure out how to use it.
We're trying.
We're trying.
We do update it every week, so
yes,
there is stuff
and,
on there.
Facebook is great. We know how to use that, and we have like 370 people now on there.
322.
Oh, is that what it is?
I checked today, so. So I encourage people to, you know, tell your friends about it. Suggest the page to your friends. I've already done that to all my friends.
So. Animal Voices Vancouver.
Yeah, Animal Voices Vancouver. And, you know, we post a lot of good stuff up there. It's a really good way to garner support, as you now know from our interview today.
Mm-hmm. And our website, please be the first one to make a comment on our website.
Yeah, we have a new website, animalvoices.org. And it just launched like about a month ago.
Yeah,
right?
And you can listen to all the past shows there. We have some really exciting shows. So listen to them and make some comments.
Yeah, we'd love to hear your comments. If they're really cool comments, we'll even read them on the show.
Yeah.
Even if they're not, we'll probably still read them on the show.
Just be the first one to make a comment. Okay, I think that's it for us this week. So thank you so much for listening to Animal Voices.